Thank you, Paul, for coming on the podcast today. I appreciate you taking the time. You are well known on Twitter and the internet as Lindy Man, and love all the content that you've put out over the years. Big fan of the general perspective on the world. I find it to be very refreshing and original and interesting, and just a great way to sort of filter your perspective and, you know, put a lens on your vision of the world. So looking forward to diving into a bunch of this stuff. But before we get started, I think a interesting place to sort of dive in would just be to describe or explain how you became the Lindy Man. You know, you weren't born this way, so how'd you sort of come across this type of stuff and become the Lindy Man that you are today?
I was a reply guy for Nutsintella for years, and but I was also in other circles too, just like posting, like I don't know. I don't know how this happened. I think one day I just decided to take this heuristic, this Lindy effect heuristic, start posting about it, and then started posting about other things. And I don't actually don't know like how you would describe, because it's not like, you go on TV or something, or somebody gives you a contract. You're just sort of just posting on Twitter, and at some point more people follow you. And so it's there's networks that retweet you, and but it's just sort of just following this heuristic and developing other ideas that are kind of adjacent to this heuristic, and the following emerged, I guess.
So maybe a different way to sort of approach that is like, when you started on Twitter, like when was that? Were you always, the handle Lindy Man? Were you always into, you got on Twitter and you started being like a reply guy for Nassim Taleb? Or, how did all of this work in parallel to your traditional career? And have you sort of transitioned out of that towards doing this full time? Maybe some answers to those questions might paint the picture a little bit.
So I was anonymous for a while. I guess I remember 2015, 2016, just kind of observing and maybe replying a little bit. And then I think once, like 2017 or 18, maybe I started posting a little bit more. And I decided to just post under my real name, because I guess I didn't think, like, why not? Like, why not? I just sort of like, I'm not posting anything crazy or things that I feel like are, that get you in trouble or something. Like, I guess I never had that kind of, because you see people posting on Instagram, like in their name all the time. And there's this real obsession on Twitter with being anonymous. And I guess it works in a lot of aspects, because it's, you can say whatever you want when you're anonymous, because there's no consequences. And I always felt like, there should be a feedback loop a little bit for, you post under your name. And if you really want to post something, I guess, that you feel maybe people may, get mad about or something, you just maybe use a metaphor. Like, there's these constraints on creativity that actually enhance the art. So I always felt like, well, they'll just make me a better poster in the end if I just have these some certain constraints as well. So I also felt like you're more real if you're a person on there. And then I just started, developing like ideas based on my life, like going to work and kind of, seeing the difference between someone who owns the business versus someone who works there, and one has to be consistent, and the other one sort of has to be in payoff space and make decisions, and their whole like lives are kind of different, and like nobody's really talking about that. I sort of there That was the time when there was a lot of easy money on Twitter, and like this, I guess all this sort of VC and startup and this whole tech kind of movement where, being a founder was applauded, or but there was nothing there for like being an employee, or like there seems like there was something missing there, that there's this whole like literature about being an employee and what it means. I call the consistency space or the 4-hour life that like nobody was really talking about. They were just talking about, owning and founding businesses. So that was just, one thing I took from my normal kind of job. And then there's the Lindy thing, which is, we're living in America during like a hyper technological time, surrounded by electronics and also social kind of changes that are happening, a lot more atomization, a lot more, people are dating through apps instead of sort of even like in person or even through families. And like there's a large shift in how we live a little bit that's happening. It's pretty subtle though, I think, because we're just adjusting to it and generations are being born, on the screen or on social media now. And so we've exited this 20th century media monoculture and we've sort of went into this new era. I grew up under this 20th century media monoculture. So, I feel like you can see differences. And then I started exploring, hey, wow, there's all these sequels. And music just seems repetitive. It seems like and fashion changes happen. There hasn't been a change in fashion from like in the population in years and decades. And there was changes every decade through all these mainstream routes. And so I developed like a stuck culture thesis of how, we're at the mainstream level, we're stuck, but at the internet level, there's lots of stuff going on, lots of innovation. But when you step outside, it seems like there's a large change in society than what it used to be. And then I started, developing, and there's also tons of tribes online, people telling you to eat certain things or take supplements or hacking the body or, trying to create alternative money like Bitcoin. And so you have this heuristic called the Lindy effect, which is, there's a reason that tradition or certain things work and have lasted over time is because they're not harmful, or at least they work. And you can kind of explore this heuristic a little bit and, analyze kind of emergent new technologies or ways of living and see if we're at a, if there's a big environmental change. Like cigarettes is probably the obvious one, right? It came into the culture in like 1920s. It's this really amazing kind of product. I never, that's easy to be, to be addicted to. It went for like 80 years and we just basically kicked it out. Like it caused a lot of people to die. Totally not Lindy. There's no precedent for humans smoking like small amounts of tobacco every day, constantly. So, and also combining it with a sedentary life. So, you could just use the past to sort of look at the future and see, we're all kind of in this world testing all these new objects, right? But which ones are sort of going to last and which one's harmful? I think this heuristic is kind of a helpful North Star for that. But to tell you that, like, I work. Still, it allows me to be free in my writing, so I'm not like captured by my audience, or I feel like I have to do things that I don't want to write about. Just having the optionality sort of helps me develop my ideas and be free in that domain. Because if I wasn't, I'd have to kind of like ride different, I don't know, hype cycles or something, or be really focused on making like a side gig kind of my main gig. And it just makes you more fragile to just have one source of income. I prefer a few others. But it also puts me in touch with reality, which is like 90 to 95% of people are employees. And you wouldn't know that on Twitter because a lot of people on Twitter are independently wealthy, or they're owners of businesses, or I call them payoff space members. And they're giving advice, which probably only applies to them and their position. So it actually helps me to sort of, and there's like a long tradition of people having jobs and writing on the side. So long, long tradition. So I can kind of see why that is.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And you bring up a ton of topics that I'd like to talk a little bit more about, but like the payoff space, consistency space, refinement culture, how culture's a bit stuck and a bunch of these things. But would love to start with Lindy. That's how I sort of got to know you in the first place. And one, you sort of introduced it just to summarize, I guess, the way I think about it, and correct me if you have any sort of corrections, but roughly, it says like the longer that something's been around, the longer it's likely to remain around. And so, when something comes in and it's pretty new, there's sort of a default skepticism about that because, there is, it's not Lindy at all. It's brand new. And who's to say whether it's going to stay around for, a couple more days or weeks or months or years or decades or centuries or whatever. And very few things stick very long, but those things that do, or have historically, are very Lindy. So I think it'd be interesting to sort of, I think a lot about sort of like the fundamental aspects of life, and we'll sort of, maybe we can take a Lindy lens on some of those things. You've got like the one Twitter account, Lindy Diet, that is pretty interesting to me. But before we do that, as sort of like a macro level, anything about Lindy and sort of, how to think about it as sort of a law of nature or something like that. Do you think, sort of one thing I wonder is, basically, is time consistent over time? And what I mean by that is something being around for, 1 year now, does that give it a lot more credit than, if it were to have been around for 1 year, 200 years ago, or make it 10 years 200 years ago versus 10 years today? Like, I think time seems to be moving faster in terms of the velocity of change, just by the virtue of sort of technology. Things, you used to be able to be born some number of years ago and you could pretty reliably predict what the world would look like when you died. Like, there wasn't that much that was going to be that different. Today, I really, it's very difficult for me to say what the world's going to look like in, 2080, because, things just are changing all the time. And maybe not year over year, it doesn't seem like that big of a difference, but 5 years ago, a whole lot less people were working remotely. No one was really thinking about pandemics. AI wasn't really a thing other than like a, hot buzzword or whatever. And the world was quite different. So do you sort of assign, like, is it easier for something to become Lindy over a shorter period of time today? And do you sort of discount, hundreds of years of Lindiness in the past versus, 10 years of being around today?
The problem is, I don't know where we are in this cycle. So if this was 1960, we'd both be smoking a lot of cigarettes, and we wouldn't really know. Maybe we do know it's kind of bad for you, but cigarettes are going to be are part of the culture, and they're not going away, right? Like, and I almost think that's where we are with a lot of these screens, or a lot of, or you can even, we're just sort of smoking away with technology and just consuming tons of information on a daily basis. And I mean, I don't know where we are. Like, if something comes, like for example, the car. Car is about 100 years old at this point. And it completely transformed the environment, right? I mean, nothing like the car culture, what they call like suburbs and highways and transportation and living long distances away and how we interact with our neighbors. This is a massive invention, but they just came out with self-driving cars. That's on the road in San Francisco. And is that going to replace the car? Like, the car replaced the horse, and then does the self-driving car actually take us back to more of a, like, I guess, a more of a Lindy kind of world where, hey, that car is just driving around. Whenever I need it, it'll be here, and I can now, build housing or engage with the community different, like maybe historic, more historically than I could now, which is living in a world shaped by the personal car. Okay, so it's like everything's moving right now. Inventions sometimes take us to new places, and other times inventions take us to places that we've come from. Like Apple's releasing their new goggles. Well, if I just wear goggles every day, I don't have these like screens or laptops or computers or these or in my house. I can actually make my house look like a house 100 years ago with nice furniture. And once every technology entered the home as furniture, the stereo looked like furniture, the TV, wood paneling looked like furniture. And we just gave up and let technology kind of overtake the home, and with these big black screens everywhere. And does these, do these VR goggles, whatever you call them, is it going to transform the home back to something that it was before screens? Because then you just, if you need to do your internet stuff, you just go and put on the goggles, and you go back to the real world. So it's tough determining where we are, first of all, what effects these new technologies are going to have. And I don't really think in yeah, there's an argument that time is speeding up, and because there's so many people now have access to the same amount of information that a year 500 years ago would not equal a year today. I've heard that. There's, just because of such the masses of people, so things are actually accelerating. Lindy's actually accelerating. I've heard that argument too, but I don't know if that's sort of helpful, because I think just using the heuristic by itself and linearly is good enough, without sort of the speculation. And I think it can be really helpful to your day-to-day life, and without even having to go into those areas.
Yeah, I think I wasn't expecting necessarily like a definitive answer, like yes, that is the case, or no, that's not, or here's how much it is, or whatever. But I think it's an interesting question, and to your point, it doesn't change, the thinking about things in terms of Lindy is still very useful, regardless of sort of the answer to that question. But I'll sort of present, one thing, obviously pretty popular that this might sort of impact, and ask like sort of a relative question of how it could sort of impact your view. So, take Bitcoin, right? And take gold. Gold, like extremely Lindy. Bitcoin been around for, 14 years, something like that. And so in addition to the question of like, are those 14 years worth like as much as the first, several hundred years of gold being around, because the value of time is sort of different, or sort of the, yeah, basically the value of time is different. That's sort of one question. And then the other question is like, well, if you're getting more sort of credit for hanging around per year or per decade now than you might have for like a century in the past, then, is there sort of like a threshold for these new things that do come in where beyond a certain threshold, you sort of have a pretty good idea that, okay, at that point, like even though this has only been 14 years or 20 years or 25 years or whatever it might be, in the modern world, like that is now Lindy. Like that has been long enough. And obviously for cigarettes, like, they were around for decades, sort of, went away for the most part, obviously at least peaked, not Lindy. But for something
Well,
like
I
the
think
internet.
we need generational churn now. And I don't think you can say anything without generational churn. It's like I think a lot of the internet is going away. A lot of it has gone away. Like your old Angel Fire, GeoCities, MySpace pages are gone. A lot of links to Wikipedia don't work anymore. And now that those interest rates have risen, you're seeing like announcements saying, Google's going to delete some old accounts. So we're not going to touch YouTube yet, but YouTube's next. Old videos are next. Like, it costs money to store all this stuff. And I think that there's going to be a mass deletion process happening very soon. And there's something to the internet that maybe has problems with preservation. I mean, we're still early. We hasn't even been one. I haven't handed my computer off to my grandkids or something, right, and died, and like see what they preserved it. So we're still early, but I think generational churn is very important because that's exactly how we have a lot of our intellectual works that have been preserved. So if you look at why do we have like Seneca's writings or all this philosophy? Well, that was transcribed at that time, and there was bookstores. They read them. Okay, they died. Then there was like, the church came in and said, church held it, and the church sort of transcribed it. It's just this human process of preserving and transferring is how we got those things. It's also how we know diets work. Like the Lindy diet is just a religious diet that has been practiced by monks in Christianity as monks, right? So you go there and you eat this diet and you work all day, and they actually live pretty long lives. We know that. We have record of that. So I don't know what eating just keto does, or just vegan. Now, there are some Indian traditions that are vegetarian, but they've probably honed the amount of food or the type of nutrients in their food to be able to survive on that. Now, if I'm just some guy in New York going to Whole Foods as a vegan vegetarian, and I'm not part of some tradition, I may then, I may think, oh, now I'm have to get vitamins for a deficiency. Well, now I'm undergoing another non-Lindy thing, which is, mega doses, daily mega doses of some antioxidant that you see reports how it fuels cancer a little bit. It was just generally pathways matter too. So we just need proof of some generational churn. I don't think we're there with the internet. We're not there with Bitcoin yet. These are still early technologies, but we can make pretty good assumptions about other things though, like exercise or attention or social trust. So it works in many other areas, but I'd argue you can't really talk about it without generation churn.
Right. No, that makes total sense. And hadn't really thought of it as like sort of that deliberately, but that does make sense. So even if time is moving faster, you might sort of assign, maybe a fewer number of generations is as meaningful as a much larger number of generations in the past. But even still, without one single generation churn, at least, let alone multiple, pretty hard to,
Yeah, right. It's
have
just
large confidence that something's going to stick around.
right. And yeah, I mean, a lot of the Loeb Classical Library, is 2,000 years old. Stoicism is sort of a fad or something, but that is 2,000 years old that has been transmitted generationally and sort of read by a lot of people over history. And so yeah, we need at least one, I would say.
You brought up Lindy Diet, and you've got this Twitter account, Lindy Diet, that has basically every day posts like today is a fast, refrain from meat, dairy, and fish, or today is fast
Right.
free, no fasting restrictions. You're sort of celebrating with nice looking pictures of these
Yeah.
Lindy foods and things like this. What is I'm assuming this is a diet that you're following, or at least mostly following. It's not fasting as I sort of know it, in that you're not fasting from everything. At least that's not the only way to fast. Can you sort of describe the diet? I know, like, I think you wrote breakfast is not Lindy. It sort of matched a lot of, I've been intermittent fasting now for I don't know, 6, 7 years, something like that. And it was one of the sort of the first levers that I pulled that helped me to, improve my health. And I mostly just do, stop eating after dinner and don't eat until lunch the next day. So it's like 16 hours or so, maybe a little more, a little less sometimes. But I haven't really dabbled with like, I think I did like 1 2-day fast. I haven't really dabbled with like anything any regular long-term fasting or anything like that, or any,
right,
you know, pescatarianism, which I think is involved with what you're doing. So if you could talk about sort of your primary principles, the things you have like the highest conviction in from a Lindy perspective, and, you know, just how you go about it.
Yeah, I just adapted this religious diet. It's in the Greek Orthodox, or it's Orthodox, pan-Orthodox diet of, you know, there's, I think there's like 150 to 200 vegan days. Then there's like another 50 pescatarian days. And you're in constant cycling of protein. You're in constant cycling of fish. And I don't know. I don't know why, you know, it meets the hallmark of what Lindy is, which is we have a test group of monks from a variety of cultures that have been engaging with this diet, you know, their test group. They do tend to have longer longevity than other people. The mechanisms for why it works. I mean, I don't know. We're omnivores. So eating a steak every day is probably not Lindy. I don't know. I mean, there's probably some hunter gatherers, I guess the Maasai in Kenya, or I guess there's these Alaskan Inuits that only eat fish. Like there's these outliers that have kind of extreme diets, you know, I guess the notion is too much protein every day might wreck your kidneys, or deprivation is a good thing. Like I fast, I don't eat breakfast. I don't do a lot of long-term fasting. Like maybe I'll go a day or two every 6 months. It's a very helpful thing. Our bodies are not made for abundance. Our bodies are made for deprivation. They get stronger through deprivation, which is one of the problems with living our life today, which is you can have any delicious food we want, and food now is better than at any time in history. So it takes a lot of discipline to, you know, eat a certain way and not I would say eat badly. And I think, you know, that's probably in previous cultures we've only been around a certain amount of food, like a certain cuisine that we've always eaten. Which is right now, especially if you're living in a place like America, you can have anything you want at any time. And I just generally think that that's not a way we've ever lived. And that's probably going to get the regular person into trouble. Again, America's got really high obesity rate. Now they're trying to fix obesity with semaglutide. So these new drugs that you inject. I actually tried it too, just to see if it works, because I want to see if I want to invest in it. And number two, I generally like to do non-Lindy things just to see what it's like. And if it might become Lindy, or if it solves an issue, or if there's going to be side effects. So I tried it and I thought, oh wow, this is going to be really effective. It just makes you full all the time, but it's probably not the Lindy way to lose weight. Like it's going to cause some side effect and probably hasn't emerged what these side effects are at this point, but generally just taking some drug to make you feel full all the time is now sounds great and it's going to make a lot of money for a lot of people, but you know, it's a way for us to find order in a world without any structure, without any traditions, without any ways of eating. And you know, food in a way, food cults have replaced religion in a lot of ways. Like you can almost tell a lot about someone's political affiliation by their diet. Like if they're into like keto, carnivore, I might be more of a libertarian right wing guy. I mean, it associated itself with like Bitcoin and more of a masculine viewpoint. And then there's like vegan and vegetarianism, which has become a little bit more feminine and liberal. And because we live in a little bit of a post-religious world and humans, you know, engage with tribes everywhere. So food tribes have sprung up. And for me, it's like, well, I look at that and I go, I don't think either of these are Lindy. Now, where can I go? What diet did we see generational churn? Do we see, you know, people not being harmed? And, you know, I found this one and I just sort of, I follow it. I mean, it's not 100% strictly, but it just gives me a little bit of a foundation to at least know that I'm not going to be caught up in some fad. And I go to the doctor, and this particular diet that I'm on, or lack of any diet, actually, lack of any structure, is causing some health problems because our bodies are complex systems. And this is sort of the easiest way to integrate them into our life, like the body, right? I mean, the body needs certain things, and certain exercise every day, certain foods and liquids. And you can even say, I'm not going to eat or drink a liquid that's younger than 500 years. You can even say that, and you'll probably be safer for that. Why does it work? I don't know. I don't have to know why. I know it has, and I know it won't harm you. But yeah, it's an application that I utilize, and I'm sure there's other diets too. It's not the only diet. There's lots of ways to eat that other cultures have developed, and but generally, this was a diet kind of followed by Catholics before, I think before they reformed it in the 50s. So it does have a lot of use throughout the populations.
Yeah, it's interesting. I sort of wonder if there's any, you were mentioning like the different cultures and the different diets, and this is one that was fairly widespread, but there's others and
Right.
like more carnivore style or something like this. And I wonder if almost for like a given person, it's worth considering your ancestry as far back as you could sort of look at it and what that means, like probabilistically about how far, where you come from way, way back, and if that sort of could have an impact on how you think about some of these things, such as like diet. But another, related to nutrition and diet more generally, you've got this really interesting theory on hydration, where I've sort of had this idea for a while that I don't really have great support for it, and I hesitate to just put out theories out there without much support, but it seems like maybe drinking a lot of water could just be like very underratedly good for you. A lot of people don't really pay attention to water. They don't talk about water really. They talk about fix your diet, exercise daily, eat your vegetables, sleep well.
Right.
No one really talks about water, and it's like so fundamental. It's in every life form, and like it's just how, I don't know how we sort of overlook it. Obviously, people know it's not good to be like severely dehydrated, but it would seem to me that there is sort of like a right and a wrong range to be in for how hydrated you are. And so basically you've sort of observed, which I think a lot of people will sort of resonate with, that people today look a lot younger than they did 50 years ago. Like a 50-year-old today looks like as young or younger than like a 35-year-old in the 70s or something like this. On average, people just are looking younger, and it's kind of weird. And some people say maybe, well, people are smoking less and exposed to people who smoke a lot less. Maybe that's it, and sort of can just like have that as like kind of an easy answer. But maybe that's not the answer. And you sort of pose that maybe it's this like sort of step increase in the amount that people are drinking water. Can you talk a little bit about like sort of how you came to that theory and maybe describe parts of it that I didn't really effectively summarize?
I think most people have noticed that when watching older movies, and it includes, I think, up to the 90s too, in the 90s, where see somebody that's 21 or 22, and they look like they're in the 30s or 40s. They just look older. And there's like a famous YouTube video that says, no, it's actually hairstyles and clothes. They're actually they don't actually look older. Like there's like a quest to figure out this problem of why do people look older at the same age as we do now? And to me, it's very obvious. It's in the face. It's not just clothes and hairstyles. Like if you just seen a lot of pictures, and I'm looking at a face of someone that's a lot older than like 21 or 25, and just everybody kind of realizes this. It's one of those things where you bring it up and people are like, yeah, they know it is true. I've noticed that. And I think, well, what happened, what, 25 years ago, 30 years ago? Well, we had like a hydration revolution. They started selling us water bottles, and started seeing people carry water bottles around. and drinking water everywhere. And before that, yeah, you didn't drink water. Like, if you ask, you have to ask your parents or grandparents or relatives if you're younger, but you just had like a sip at the fountain and maybe a glass at home, maybe. That's it. Like, you didn't drink water. Like, you drink maybe a coffee, a juice, milk, if that, but nobody's just drinking water. And I thought, well, there was this hydration revolution where we're being told, we're being pushed, that it's part of a broader health revolution with whole foods coming in and exercise and taking care of your health and, everybody's an athlete, and there was just a broader health revolution that happened that water was part of. And yeah, if you look at statistics and sales, you see like water bottles, and then you had, they made like permanent water bottles, and people started drinking Gatorade like that without sugar, and everybody just starts drinking water all the time. Lots of water. I mean, I drink lots of water all day. I mean, I kind of cut it down a little bit actually, but so I thought, well, this, and it's been, there's some studies, not a lot of studies, that women have always drink water for skin health, and that's always been in that world for them. And there's some studies that say, water's really good for you. So why not water being the reason for why people look a lot younger? Because we've never just drank. Part of it's sedentary. So I'm sitting at a desk and I'm just taking water as I'm sitting at my desk all day. And, if everybody's sort of in a sedentary lifestyle, that's easy to do. So yeah, I thought this would be as good explanation as any. Is it healthy or not? I don't know. I mean, you look younger. Is that good? I mean, I guess so, but what if you're constantly flushing your system, and our system wasn't meant to be constantly flushed all the time? Like, what if, food deprivation is good for you, right? When you fast, it actually makes you stronger. Well, what if water deprivation has that effect a little bit? And we see some water fasting in like Judaism or Islam a little bit. So I can't tell you if it's good for you, but it probably does have an effect. And maybe the effect is you just look younger.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is you, by relying on sort of the Lindy lens, you sort it's sort of hard with like something new that gets introduced, and you don't see a precedent for it in history, and therefore it's not really, it's not Lindy, and you can't know whether it's going to be successful or not. It's difficult to you're naturally going to be skeptical of sort of these new things. And I mean, like you said, you like to try these things and, try to determine for yourself, like, is this going to be Lindy? Is it really solving a problem? Whatever. But it's
Right.
sort of, it would be very hard naturally to identify the rare thing that comes along that is actually sort of an improvement upon like history, sort of, where it's like, this hasn't been tried before, but this is genuinely good. So, for example, for whatever reason, maybe people historically, and again, we're not seeing pictures of people like way back when or whatever, but we can't really look back and see like people drinking as much water as we are today. And granted, that's not really like a technology or anything like that, but it's just a sort of a matter of circumstance. And like, maybe it is the case that drinking more than you're thirsty to drink, drinking, three times as much as you would drink if you just drink it when you're thirsty or whatever, or drinking juice and coffee, maybe that actually is really good for you. Maybe that sort of adds 5 or 10% lifespan or whatever it is, and makes you healthier longer and whatever, in addition to just having better looking skin or whatever it might be. It's just sort of hard to it's hard to know, but ultimately, I guess, in life you got to take some chances.
Well, it's also the first generation. Like, go back to generational churn. We haven't seen that first generation of, hydrated people like me and you actually go to the end of our lifespan, like we did with cigarettes, right? We saw a few generations of cigarettes. I think there was like two, maybe. And he's kind of like, okay, high cancer rates. This thing's going to kill you. Not saying that drinking water is like cigarettes, but The Lindy thing, it's just in your head and it just sort of sparks thoughts about not only new products, but the scale and volume of even older products that like getting at an excessive level. So
you stay away from most prescription drugs. Like I know you've talked about, you know, tea, deep Lindy, coffee, kind of Lindy, Adderall, not at all Lindy. I sort of recently have, you know, quit caffeine, basically, not necessarily just like a Lindy thing. Obviously caffeine is Lindy in a lot of ways, but sort of for a whole host of reasons, but I've always been very hesitant around things like Adderall, where it's just like, you know, used to be kind of like a college thing. You're cramming for finals. And then like, oh, you know, those same people who used it for finals are finding out, you know, it's pretty good for work that they don't particularly want to do, and that they, you know, better they perform, the more they get paid or whatever, get promoted. Right. And next thing you know, you're taking Adderall for life. What are your thoughts on, I guess, you know, Adderall, but also just prescription drugs in general? It's pretty hard for them to be Lindy, at least most of them, I would imagine. Do you generally lean towards, you know, not taking any, or do you sort of think, again, you know, there could be something in this category that's like, well, this isn't Lindy at all, but turns out, you know, three generations from now, we realize like this one prescription medicine actually just like net better for you. Like there's no side effects. It's just good. And it's very hard to know, but it seems like a risky game to be playing, basically.
Yeah, it's always risky with things you have to take continually that consistently cause damage or changes. Because if it's just one-offs, I'm not really worried about that. Because there's no real amount of damage that like one cigarette can do, right? It's just the problem with cigarettes is every day. And with drugs, you might want that viewpoint, which is, if I'm just going to do this once, then it's not a huge deal. But if this is going to be part of my life every day, it's going to start interacting. It's like they came out with this new study in aspirin where they're telling older people, you know, take an aspirin a day and it's good for you. And it's just, I think I was reading about it last month about how, you know, there was all these like the body's like breaking down, some internal bleeding. There's some problems with taking aspirin every day that they thought was harmless, and it really wasn't. There are complications that come up, so you always have to worry about drugs that, you know, you need to take every day, because I think that's where the real Lindy harm comes from. But yeah, I mean, I saw Adderall be a school drug for tests, and then it all of a sudden people were using it at work, and now all of a sudden ADHD is this kind of accepted this disease or condition. And you know, yeah, Adderall's, you know, makes boring things interesting. And 90% of what people do is probably not interesting at work. So, you know, it's a wonder drug for people who are working every day, or maybe who are a little bit scatterbrained and can't hold down a job. I don't know. And so I just saw that like with my eyes, just living over the years. And then I think like recently, Joe Biden administration freaked out because during COVID, you can get a prescription just by calling someone or an app, and like it rose like 300% or something. And so they ordered the FDA to, or the CDC to sort of stop production and stop supplies. So actually trying to wean Americans off of Adderall. And some people are freaking out. They're like, hey, I have a condition. This is my medication. You wouldn't do this with other drugs. And because, and you know, we don't really know how to negotiate our sort of condition-based pharma-based society yet. So it's like marijuana is also another thing where it's like, you know, smoking marijuana every day, I guess that's the issue with why it could be bad for you versus just once in a while. And that's the problem, you know, because that's unprecedented in history. You don't just see a society where people are smoking marijuana every day. So, I mean, that's a new thing, and we're testing that out. So that's how I generally see pharma drugs, which is, you know, be aware that if you had surgery and you take any pain pills, that's fine, but getting addicted to pain pills is where the issue is. So continual use is where That's what's the issue. With that being said, we're the pharma nation, right? So people need a lot of drugs, and I don't know. I mean, I don't know what to think of that because some people might need it to function. Maybe there's an exercise issue. Maybe we need 2 to 3 hours of cardio a day, like hunter gatherers or something, or people who walked around all day, and less some of these conditions would go away. Or maybe there's mental issues happening from living in this world. So it's kind of like a weird time. But for me, it's I tend to look at it as I don't want to live with a medication that I have to take every day. But if it's one-offs, then that's not an issue.
Yeah, so you mentioned, maybe we need some more cardio, maybe we should be walking around more, everything like that. You've, become well known for talking about the Lindy Walk. I think we have this in common. Yesterday was a unusual day, but basically any call I can, or any, I do this podcast, so every time I'm preparing for a podcast, I'll listen to other people, my guests that are coming on, I'll listen to them do other podcasts and sort of have like a handful of activities that I know I can do walking just as well as, sitting or standing or whatever. And then separately from that, I might just walk to go to the store or walk for, just walk to walk, without any sort of activity that goes along with it. But basically I find a lot of excuses to walk. Yesterday I walked for like literally like 4 hours. Most people are like, what the hell? Like that just doesn't like, they're like, what are you doing? Like that doesn't, that's not something that one does. But for me, it's like totally normal. And like, it's not 4 hours every day, but some days it's 1 hour, or some days it's four. I understand you walk a lot. I understand one of the things that you sort of do similarly to me is you find it to be one of the more reliable, if not the most reliable, sort of ways that you can generate ideas. Like you just go for a walk and you just have ideas. That's just like sort of how it goes. And so, most of writing, or a lot of writing, is dependent on having good ideas and thinking about things, and so walking is your like means to writing, I think, in a lot of ways, where you have these ideas, you write them down, and then later you sort of get to the computer and connect them and put out the piece or whatever it might be. Curious to hear sort of your habits around walking, if there's particular activities that you pair with it, maybe you don't do anything with it, different times of day that you think about, or taking new routes versus the same route, or certain speeds, or basically any little details about sort of your walking habit and how it's sort of been informed maybe by the lindiness of walking and things like that.
Walking is great. It's where I generate my ideas. Like you said, I think I don't really think about things when I'm sitting down. I mean, I think movement in general is we haven't solved the exercise problem, right? Like we haven't like people go to the gym and they hate it. So like I think there's like polls, like only like 20 to 30% of people actually work out a few hours a week. And of those like 20 to 30%, like 10% don't hate it. And I just, walking both is a mental thing that makes me feel better, but it's also I pair it with bicycle riding and light jogging and some other activities as sort of a movement, my movement criteria. And I think we're just not moving enough. And that's where a lot of problems are coming from. And we haven't, as a society, solved that. Like you said, you walked for 4 hours, but like I don't think you have a day job, right? And you're not in like a structure of a 4 hour life. It's just a space. You're an independent person, so you can kind of create your own schedule and you can do these things. And I think what's the real challenge is how to get someone into a more Lindy lifestyle, who actually has to work for a living, who has to socialize, maybe has a family, has responsibilities. So you only have a few hours left and you've been sedentary the whole day because you had to work. And I don't think we've solved that problem yet. And I think it's sort of a shame. And remote work helps that. If it just allows you a little bit more flexibility in where to live and what kind of lifestyle you could have. And that's a great technology that can take you to more of a natural rate of movement.
Hey, I think it might have broken up. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me? Sorry.
Yeah. You left off. You were saying I think it might be a more natural way of movement, like the remote work.
Yeah, it's a natural way of movement of so the Lindy Walk is just a random route that there's no destination. And yeah, it's just lots of ideas come from that. I feel better when I come back. I don't know. It sounds like very simple stuff, but many people don't do it, or they're in their environment where they can't do it, or they don't have enough time to do it, or they do it only on the weekends. Or and I think of how we haven't solved the exercise problem as a society, whereas people hate exercising, or they hate going to the gym, or maybe they don't want to even go walk around, or like how are we going to solve this movement issue? Because if you look at cardiovascular rates, that's the biggest threat to our health. And if you look at societies that move a lot, they have very low amounts of cardiovascular illnesses. So it kind of I don't know how to solve for that, but and I think we're at an impasse, and I hope more we become more of a health conscious society. But that's an issue. But yeah, the Lindy Walk is where I movement is where I generate everything, and I only try to be sedentary for a few hours. So.
Yeah, I think one thing that's not Lindy is like being at your computer on Zoom all day, like especially in video chat or whatever. And I think I try, like I said, I default if I have a call, it is default audio only. It is default I am walking. Like, and between the two of those, probably 90% of my overall calls, not including these podcasts, which can't really do while walking, but. And I've tried to actually solve that as well with like a mobile microphone or something. It's just not really, the quality is just not really there. But
Right.
for calls, like 90% of my calls literally, I would say, are both walking and audio only. And I'll do, if I need a screen share or something, I'll be on my computer. But rarely is that the case. And for whatever reason with COVID, like in my old job, we had tons of conference calls. They were all audio only. Maybe once in a while we do a video conference, but it's almost all audio only. Even with like seven people on the line, it was audio only. Worked totally fine. A lot of people are on the call. Myself, I was like an analyst at an investment bank, sort of trying to, my job is like listen on the call in case I'm needed, basically, but basically do nothing. So I'm like doing other work while I'm on this call that I couldn't have been doing if I was like on video the whole time. I just have this headphone in, I'm listening passively to this audio only call. And for whatever reason, we like defaulted to everything is going to be a video conference now when COVID hit and everyone went remote. And to me, it just seems so wrong. Like, I don't know. I think that's like the least Lindy thing ever. I don't know if it's going to stick around for a little bit, but it just seems so dumb that we're sitting on these calls and like how you are as an employee is dependent on how good of eye contact you're keeping with the little camera at the top of your screen. And like whether you're smiling and nodding your head versus like you don't even have to actually be listening. Someone could be pacing the room and actually listening far better and getting like a lot less credit because it looks like what the hell is this guy doing, like walking around the room while we're in this meeting. So I've thought, for people who are in the 4-hour life and have a day job and have to sort of navigate the demands of that. One interesting sort of ask I've thought about is just to ask your boss, if, obviously if there's a screen share needed or I need to be on camera, I get it, but like it's a huge priority for me to be able to walk during meetings if at all possible and to join audio only. And so like, as on the same level as like getting a promotion or a pay raise or something like that. So would love to sort of be able to default to that and, join by video when necessary. And I wonder how people, if they would be receptive to that, I'm not sure. But these, you don't need to be looking at someone, even if you're in person, you're not necessarily looking at someone when they're talking to you. A lot of great conversations happen when, you're in the front seats of a car or going for a walk or a run with someone side by side. There's no eye contact. You're just hearing it. So I think there actually counterintuitively is something like maybe a little bit Lindy about like having people in your ears with headphones or whatever, like that's not totally unprecedented. So anyway, big walking guy.
Yeah, I think audio only. I mean, if you notice, phone calls are more intimate than video calls. There's something with audio only that heightens something in our brain that lets the brain work with this negative space, whereas the video and the image is sort of this overwhelming thing that kind of takes over the entire experience. So yeah, audio only is great because you know it's just I almost think that I prefer my work day to just be audio only because I think it actually enhances a lot of concentration. It's one of those tricks that enhances concentration, like but you know that's the great part about remote work. It works like a window. So like most modern architecture is pretty bad. It's just they're taking away ornament and they're taking away angles and dimensions, but there is windows in modern architecture, and the windows bring in the sunlight and the trees and other fractal shapes. And it's like the saving grace of modern architecture is the window that allows these Lindy kind of shapes and the sunlight to come into our house. And I try to look at new technology as, is this going to allow us to live a more Lindy life? And is this going to take away older technologies that maybe are not good for us? Like, I don't think the cubicle is a new technology. And I don't know if that's it'd be nice if remote work kind of takes that away. Cause I don't know if that's necessary for people to be in every day. So.
Yeah, I think, you talked a little bit about environmental design in other contexts as well, like the benefits of, high ceilings and that it's somewhat arbitrary that we have all of our desks are facing walls because we have computers and the outlets are in the walls. And maybe that's the only reason. And actually the desk should be sort of facing, you should be facing the room or the door to the room or whatever. It's kind of a weird arbitrary thing that we all line up with these, facing the wall, which is sort of like used to be a punishment, go sit there and look at the wall or whatever. Are there other sort of core, like obviously, especially with remote work now, everyone, or even if you're in your office, whatever, you're lined up against the desk, and that's like a very fundamental thing. Like you're spending 8+ hours a day in that chair looking at that wall, and that involves, the seat, that involves the looking at the wall, sort of a few sort of furniture choices or whatever there that are really defining how you're spending your day. Are there other things that are similarly fundamental that you've thought consciously about in terms of like environmental design? So I'll give you another one just as an example would be like, your bed. I actually looked into this a while ago. I sort of questioned, this was, I think, before I was familiar with Lindy, but I was like, I've sort of had, some chronic like back issues. And I'm like, why, like, what's the deal with pillows? Like, why are we using pillows? Are these like something that have a historical precedent? And so I looked it up and like, sure enough, we actually have been using pillows for quite a long time. But I was kind of surprised to find that. So are there things that sort of in your life that you've like questioned and designed your environment a little bit differently?
Yeah, the desk thing was one. I mean, that's sort of obvious. Like there's no depth. Like taking away somebody's depth and viewpoint is punishment, right? Like that's prison, and this sort of computer monitor is 2D. And it's not providing depth, right? It's like fake depth. It's not real depth. It's like, it's not real. So in the human, I think our animal brain doesn't see the computer monitor, as like we see like a landscape or a view or a room, feet in front of us. So I think it does create sort of tension that maybe happens at a lower level. So yeah, that's one of the things, and that's because we've introduced a monitor into our world, and the monitor, we pretend the monitor is this window. It's not, and now everybody faces like the wall, and it's like, it sucks. Some other things, sometimes you'll look in history at like, and you'll see like some things that went away but were used for a while, like the alcove, this bed kind of by the window in the corner. Instead of like putting the bed in the middle of the room, you put it into like a corner by the window, and you build this little, cove, right? And I was thinking like a lot of new apartments in these cities, like New York or DC or San Francisco, I mean, they're really small, right? They're meant for like one person. Maybe they're meant for two at the most, but we're generally building small urban apartments now. And we're just totally giving up the bedroom for the bed because you can't really, it's awkward to do things around the bed. But if you do put the bed in sort of an alcove corner, you will have the bedroom as a space to do things, to be usable, instead of just having a living room kitchen combination in the front. So if you're working with 400 square feet, 600 square feet, 700 square feet, having that bedroom be usable, I mean, it could be huge. Obviously, it doesn't matter if you're in a big house in suburbs and you just use another room. So, I was looking at pictures of alcoves and of and saying, hey, this has worked for people before. This could be something to be utilized during new urbanism design in America. So you can look at things that have disappeared or not in fashion anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting. Another sort of fundamental category you've written about is sort of with the shift to remote, you don't have these like I forget which one it was actually, but you talk about like long range, medium range, close range conversations, and one of those ranges is like the sort of
Oh,
talk
yeah.
that you have with like small talk with people in the office, and you found that like after some time out of the office, you're like sort of lost in that, but like you sort of lost that ability. Which I think obviously a lot of people would sympathize with or empathize with. And so there's, these different types of relationships as defined by, these long, medium range, close range conversations that you talked about. But then also there's re the nature of relationships in and of themselves are changing quite a bit. And especially obviously the way people are meeting with this sudden shift to like, it was like the dating apps were becoming like very popular and everything. But then with COVID, it was just like they became the thing. Like that's how people meet now for the most part. And
Right.
do you have thoughts on sort of that as a historical, in the historical context of how people used to meet and the tradition of marriage and thing and or even dating? Maybe that's sort of even in and of itself, it's not that Lindy, I don't know. Thoughts on sort of where we are with that?
Yeah, I talked about yeah, I went back to the office to for, to hang out, and I didn't exercise that muscle of that coworker relationship, which is not your family or your close friends, which you can say anything, or and it's not your acquaintance, like somebody you see in the neighborhood or at the store, and you kind of talk a little bit. So and you're in the workplace, you can't say something that could be potentially be offensive, but you still have to kind of be a little funny and warm. So it is this muscle that once you take away and you get brought back into this world, and then there's hierarchies too. So you can't talk to someone completely like there's no hierarchy, the hierarchies don't exist. And you're in a role, and it's a whole thing that I felt. And you can only feel a lot of things once you've not been in it. Take something away, that's when you know something's real. So yeah, remote work took away that workplace chatter. That is different than acquaintance distance or family and friends distance, which I mean, I don't really need that level, to be honest. But yeah, there was an effect there. Yeah, there's these big changes that happen, and I see that some other people have said the same thing. I forgot, what was the end of your last question?
Just to speak on like sort of this very unprecedented place where we're at now, where
Oh, dating, right? Dating,
people are
right?
meeting by the
Yeah,
apps, and
that's
it's just weird.
huge changes. That's huge. Like, I had to grow up. You may have to grow up too to be able to approach a woman in public and, court her and, and get her number and say something and kind of get to approach someone physically. And that was a change from before, which was, your family meetings, maybe some close-knit church or community or other type of institution. Now, courtship's always kind of existed. Like, if you look at the writings of Ovid, or there's some other medieval writers who, people were seducing each other. That's a long time. I mean, that's happened a long time, and there's some liter there's old literature on that that still actually works today. But for general, for the masses, and for coupling, I went through. I had to go through a time when I had to, learn how to talk to a girl that I didn't know, and kind of talk about topics and shared culture. To now, I have to optimize a dating profile. And what does that mean? Well, that, and what do I have to signal? Well, I got to put some travel photos. If I, I got to signal that I, I'm part of maybe a white collar class, that I am cultured maybe, if I want to attract someone else who's maybe liberal or culture or worldly, or maybe I want to attract more of a conservative. And so I'll do my profile this other way. Or like, there's a lot going on here. And then there's like the chatting, the text stuff, which is, that's not a real life conversation. That's new too. So we used to optimize for something else. Now we're optimizing for this. It's all disarray. It's interesting. I mean, people find a way, right? Don't want to be alone. So, people are getting together, getting married still, but yeah, it's a time of, some pretty big changes. I don't know if we're leading to something else in the future. If this is just a temporary thing, or if this is how it's going to be now for a while, or it'll evolve. It's kind of a new world. Once we sort of cut, once what, like 1950s, 60s, sort of, once that sort of traditional culture ended, and we started moving into a courtship, independent, everybody's independent kind of culture. We've gone through a lot of swings. Who knows? I don't know. I mean, we're seeing a drop in, I think, weddings, and also in children. So there's some effect, right? People are having less kids and people are marrying less. So, there's a lot more single people today. So it's a time of change.
Yeah, I sort of wonder with this, you mentioned just how odd and seemingly arbitrary many of the aspects of the dating apps are, and like they've all sort of conformed. I know there's like slight differences between a few of the popular ones or whatever, but they're all basically the same thing. It's sort of what you described. And I wonder, to our conversation earlier about like the audio only, and something that might resemble more so going up to someone and striking a conversation or whatever, very different than optimizing a profile and learning how to text or whatever that might be. I've wondered, like, is there room for a hugely sort of different version of a dating app that is like rethought from the ground up? So like one version could be you enter some information or whatever, and then the system sort of tries to match you with someone reasonably well. And you end up like the first step, instead of like, they're not looking at your profile, there's no swiping or anything like that. You're actually just introduced to have maybe an audio only conversation, which, like we said earlier, is like, I think we both agree, is actually much better in a lot of ways than a video conversation. And in this case, it's also preserving sort of instant judgments about someone's appearance. And you sort of get to know the person a little bit by audio. And then if you sort of both opt in or whatever, you can, maybe meet in person or whatever. And then it's like, it's kind of like a blind date, but you've talked and you can sort of, you see if you're attracted to the person, or whatever it might be. And a lot of times maybe you aren't, but if you are, like, that's kind of a much like deeper way to like sort of get introduced to someone, I feel like, much. And it doesn't have to be like some like revolutionary deep conversation or whatever, but at least you're just like talking and you can like hear someone's voice and get a much better feel for them than text on a screen and like, which parts of the world they've traveled to or whatever, what their dog looks like or whatever it might be.
Yeah. It might be more of an indirect future though too. Like, if someone, like when you're on Twitter, you're reading someone's thoughts. And that could be a dating app too, which is, hey, I've been reading your thoughts for a while, or here's a picture. So you post a picture randomly. I'm gonna go in your DMs, or even on LinkedIn. Like, these places that are meant for something else turn into dating apps, right? They're all eventually turn into dating apps. So maybe the dating app isn't actually the dating app, it's some other app that has nothing to do with dating that becomes secretly a matchmaker type, or societally, or there's something we unlock with, like a Twitter, Instagram, where, dating becomes like socially acceptable on there, that maybe it isn't as now, but could be that too. But
yeah,
Man, I don't know. It is a time of change. It's but yeah, I don't think we're in a refinement culture stage with dating apps. They're all the same thing. They all look the same, and I don't think anybody's sort of brought on a new model yet.
Yeah, maybe we can wrap up by talking a little bit about refinement culture. But before we do, I just one comment on your sort of thinking of the dating app as like a feature rather than like an app in and of itself, and potentially Twitter being an
Yeah.
option. I've thought about this like in the context of like not matching partners, like romantic partners, but friends. I think friends, sort of making friends, has undergone a similar increase in friction and change in the nature of how you make new friends as relationships have, but romantic relationships. But we sort of, the dating apps were already around and they were just poised to blow up. You sort of, everyone needs like, or need, but it's sort of, you prioritize getting into a relationship if you're not, or meeting, at least meeting people of the opposite sex if you're not meeting them. And so that sort of needed to happen quickly. Friendships are sort of like maybe considered a little bit more of like an optional thing, where like you sort of have old friends already, maybe, and like there's not like a dire need to necessarily like make new friends that's like immediately apparent. Like if you don't meet a new friend for a couple of years, like that's kind of fine, like if you, as long as you already have like a friend or two or whatever. But I've thought of Twitter in that context of like Twitter seems like a great place. I don't know about romantic partners, because frankly, it's just like a lot of men. But and maybe, I mean, it could work as well. There are obviously women on Twitter, and maybe it works. But for friend making, I've met a lot of really awesome, like sort of like-minded people on Twitter, and I feel like they could easily introduce something that just, they have nothing in the product currently that actually, explicitly facilitates that. Like, hey, here's this person. You've been liking a lot of their posts, or whatever. Turns out, they live 20 miles away from you or whatever. You guys should meet up for coffee or like whatever. I don't know what the exact mechanism is, but something to explicitly make friends. And I do think something like that for both friend making and dating is like super intriguing. Basically looking at these places where the internet can sort of like arrange you sort of by accident, by virtue of sort of like what the product is, rather than an explicit dating app that you go to meet someone. You know what I mean?
I think explicit is a romance killer. And I think once you get into the world of seduction or of happenstance, or I mean the real world is all about sort of random synchronicity. And I think something that can replicate the real world is probably better than literally a dating app, which is explicit. So yes.
So I know we're coming up on time, and appreciate you taking all the time. But refinement culture is super interesting to me. This culture is stuck concept that you have, 20th century media monoculture. If you could sort of introduce that for people who aren't familiar and describe what you've noticed, what you think is going on, why that might be happening, maybe we could just sort of wrap the conversation on that topic, because I think it's super interesting and it's hard not it's like hard to unsee once you've sort of thought about it a little bit.
Yeah, it's just this flattening of this global aesthetics, what I call the refinement culture, but also other stuff, like in sports games, just a removal of diversity and heading, and embracing some sort of optimal level. So every cars all look the same now. A lot of new apartments or new construction looks the same. And like even with cars, we're removing colors. Like if you go on the road, you'll just mostly see gray, white, and black. Like, and there used to be tons of other colors like 40, 50 years ago, and those have gradually dissipated. But it's happening everywhere. Like the NBA basketball is now optimized. So the top 200 shots are either the 3-point or layups, and this whole mid game. This mid-level game is gone because it's not as efficient. They brought in sort of data people to talk, to examine what is the most efficient way to play. And that's the most efficient way to play. And you see this with other sports. This is the global removal of diversity. People have less accents than they did, also less regional accents. Interiors look a little, are more gray, right? New renovations look the same. And I don't know why it's happening. I'm sure there's some sort of explanation around, this is a safe bet that the most amount of people would like to resale. Maybe there's some algorithms are pushing us that way. But it is a lot of sameness going on. And the world is becoming much more similar as we're more connected. Like I travel, and when you travel, you'll see the baseball hat everywhere, but you won't see any other hat. But go back 100 years ago, there was like millions of hats, total, and each region had a hat, and they're all gone. So it seems like the more we're connected, the more diversity we lose. And I don't see a way out of this because I don't think anybody wants to really get disconnected. So, yeah, it's just an interesting thing to examine, which is, it's, look at how sane the world looks, like women's makeup or Instagram models or internet apps, web pages, or Twitter clones. There's like five Twitter clones. They look exactly like Twitter. Nobody else thought of to do anything different and just copy Twitter. And I don't know. I don't really. It just seems like there's more connection. There's more. We have problems with diversity.
Yeah, it's weird, and it's other examples I think you've talked about. It's like we don't have like new fashion trends, we don't have new movies,
Right.
we don't have new music. It's just
At
sequels
the
and
mainstream level.
re-releases. Yeah.
But but that's a problem because like I can go on YouTube and there's a whole universe for me on YouTube or on Twitter or on Instagram. But we're not sharing this. This is my own personal consumption, and we have trouble. If we don't have common culture, we can't share that with each other. And I think after a while, the stuckness of common culture, it degrades and things get maybe a little weird. So, there is an argument though that the 20th century was the non-Lindy period, and we're going back to a more Lindy period of people in little tribes. And yeah, we're not consuming the same thing. We can't talk about the show we watched last night because we're watching way different things. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's another time we're entering. It's kind of weird considering that I remember kind of a common culture that may not be as around anymore. So.
Cool. Well, again, appreciate you coming on and taking the time. It's been awesome talking with you. I'll wrap things there. I know I've taken, as much or more of your time than you had, so really
Yep.
appreciate it. But where can people go to, you want to send them to the Substack, or actually it's not a Substack anymore, right? It's Beehive, I think. And
Beehive. Just go to my Twitter, my name. Just go to my Twitter. It's fine.
all right, and that's at Lindy Man for people who don't know. So awesome. Thanks again for coming on, and look forward to keeping in touch.
All right. Thanks.